This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our program Main Street because in North Dakota, those are important streets in our towns. We go there to do some business, see folks, share our news and opinions, talk about this or that. And on a summer day, it's nice to talk about a good book, you know? It's like a special treat in the summer when it's nice out to be in a hammock and maybe have the occasional distraction of a bird song or a gentle breeze. And if it's a rainy day, that's no problem. Just throw open the window, prop yourself up in your favorite chair, and pull out that book. Jill Condell is a local author. She spent years far from the prairie of her youth in Zambia in South Central Africa. The result was a story. The intrigue is constant, the problems plentiful, the journey deeply moving. Condell is the author of So Many Africas, 6 Years in a Zambian Village. It's the kind of book that doesn't take too long to read, but its content will stay with you for a long time. She spoke with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg in January.
Jill, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You have packed a lot into this 175 pages. There are more trials and tribulations. There is such spirituality and joy and life and death. And this is more lifetimes than I think most of us will have in five or six lives.
Yeah, we lived in Africa for 6 years. And I often say if you've lived in Africa for 5 minutes, you have a story to tell. So living there for 6 years, I could have written a book that was three times as long.
Yeah, it makes me wonder. We're going to get to that part of how did it take so long to get this book out. But, I mean, you grew up in North Dakota.
I did. I grew up in Valley City, spent the first 20 years of my life there. Went to college in Bismarck, got a nursing degree at the University of Mary.
And some 8,400 miles as the crow flies. You end up in this rural African village. How did that happen?
It happened because of a man. I met my husband in Portland, Oregon, and he's from the Netherlands. A year later, we got married, and on our honeymoon, we decided that we would go to work in Zambia. He had been there 3 years before and worked with agriculture, and it was his dream and his life, and I wanted to be a part of that. So we signed the contract on our honeymoon and worked with the Dutch volunteers, and we were married 6 weeks and got on an airplane. Flew to Lusaka, Zambia, which is a capital city, and then we boarded a bus. We took a 12-hour bus ride west across the plains and through some beautiful country. When we got to the city of Mongu, we got on a little canoe, and it was another 12 hours across the floodplain, across the Zambezi River, down the Luangwa River, and we got out on a little spit of sand, and that was my home.
Wow. And all of that within just a few weeks of being married.
Yes.
I take it you and your husband, Johan, aren't much for pillow talk here.
Yeah. He was, he just had a bug for Africa. And I had been to Japan before, and I had worked in Africa for 3 months as a nurse, just kind of trying it out. So I was curious about the world. I wanted to see more and do more. I love North Dakota. I love growing up here. I grew up with horses, and it was a fantastic childhood. But there was something about when I met him, I just wanted to see more of the world.
Hmm. So. And you said that you had visited Africa, and you talk about this in your book, that your first visit there working as a nurse, very different circumstances
very
from
different.
The second time. So can you kind of detail the differences? What was your first trip like?
My first trip, I went over as a student nurse, and I worked at an American mission hospital, which was also having a lot of British people at it. So it was a mission that had started probably 80 years earlier, a compound, brick houses, all the infrastructure, people from different countries, they spoke English, the hospital was well-stocked, I could speak to people, there was food, it was in a city, and I expected that I could handle Zambia because I'd done that, and I had no idea that living on a compound with primarily expatriates would be a very, very mm-hmm. different experience than living in a village where for many of the years I was the only native English-speaking person.
So you had the movie trailer version as a student nurse, and then you
certainly
ended up
did.
With the feature film here with your husband. Can you take us back to, I mean, you already talked about this hugely long journey just getting there. Do you remember your first thoughts when you were realizing this is my new home?
I wasn't prepared for the isolation. Getting on a canoe and sitting in it for 12 hours, you get rained on. We got sunburned. We're hungry. There was one place to stop on the 12-hour trip at a little fish house that had a very disgusting bathroom. So I would say it was kind of both a parade in that it was exotic and exciting, and it was overwhelming, and I really hit some culture shock walls.
Yeah. It seems like trips like that, they all of a sudden something just hits you.
Yeah.
Do you remember what it was?
I think for me, yes, I do. It was sitting out after we'd been there for about a month, and we didn't have a house for the first 6 months that we lived in this village. We were supposed to have a house, and it was promised to us by the Zambian government, but a policeman moved into it. So we didn't have a house. So we lived in this little room of a guest house, which is a sort of rundown hotel. And Hans and I were sitting outside one night, and we looked up at the stars, and the stars were different. And I remember looking for the Big Dipper, and it wasn't there. And I didn't know where. I felt so lost because riding my horse across the prairie, I knew the stars, and I knew the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper and Orion's Belt. And I'm sitting outside in this strange country with this man who I've been married to for maybe 8 weeks at that point, and he spoke a different language, and even the stars are different. And I just felt like everything was unsettled. It felt like being kind of in a hurricane in the center of everything moving around you, and you don't know where to set your feet because nothing quite makes sense.
And even if it did, you wouldn't necessarily have the words to express it.
Right.
Can you tell me about some of the language barriers that you faced?
Sure. Zambia as a country has 60 languages, and the province we moved to, there were five separate languages. So there was Lozi, Luvali, Nyango, Mbunda, and Khoya. And I didn't speak any of them. And so I'd go to the village market and try to find my way, but I didn't even know which of the five languages were being spoken to me. So it was very difficult, to say the least, to try just to ask for simple things. I need some tomatoes, can I buy meat, you know, and you don't know how to say those things. And so you feel very isolated in a situation which is already geographically isolated. I think you become emotionally and intellectually isolated also.
I can see how that would be such a huge issue for just anybody on a personal, emotional level. But I'm wondering, as a writer, as someone who has a much deeper appreciation for language than most people, was that especially hard for you?
Well, I wasn't a writer yet. I was a big reader. Words meant a lot to me. I journaled. I would say, yes, that words have always been very important to me. So to lose the words in my life felt like I was losing my own language. And I stopped talking to people. And in a sense, when you stop talking to people, you stop hearing yourself. And so you become isolated even from your own mind because you're not talking about what you're thinking. And it becomes a kind of silence that you live with.
Wow. How hard was it to stay in touch with the people back home?
There were no telephones. No internet, obviously. We had mail service, and a letter home took about 6 weeks. Sometimes it could take 2 or 3 months, so I wrote letters and mailed them off, and that was really our only communication for most of the years. Off and on, for a period of a few months, we would have a telephone available. I called home once when my daughter was born, when our first daughter was born.
Christina.
I remember talking to my parents for about 3 minutes, and it cost $98 or something to that effect.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very crackly, and you couldn't really hear very well anyway. So, and now we live with texts and instant messaging, and we have friends who are overseas, and they send us photos, and it's a sort of wonder that that even exists. My husband has been back to Zambia, and every other person has a cell phone now. And I have a very hard time imagining that, mm-hmm. because when we lived in Kalamo, there was no communication.
And this was the 80s?
Yes, middle 80s.
And that was also a time of a lot of violence in Zambia.
Violence
or nearby.
In Angola. Angola was about 20 miles away from us. We lived right near the border. And there was civil war in Angola at the time. So the United Nations worked in Kalabo Village. They had the High Commission for Refugees there. So a lot of Angolan refugees were coming through our town that we would see sort of the outflow of the war and what was happening there.
How scared were you about that?
Not, I would say. It seemed like it was a different country. And they were coming to us for safety and for shelter, so that in itself wasn't a scary situation as far as soldiers and that type of thing.
You have a great story in your book about one that I think really illustrates the cultural barriers that you can face living half a world away from where you grew up. And that is, you meet a young woman at the riverside, and you two have a wonderful discussion about swimsuits.
Who would think?
Yeah. Tell that story for us.
I spoke with a few of the women in town. Primarily, the women who were more educated spoke some English, and there was a small hospital in town, so some of the nurses spoke English. And I would do activities with them, and I went to the Luangingo River one afternoon to go swimming, and she was very surprised at my swimsuit and affronted. And I looked down at this navy blue one-piece plain swimsuit, and I thought I was being very modest for mm-hmm. American standards. And I look at her, and she has on a swimsuit, but she's covered up her legs with a cloth called a shitenge. And she said, "I would never show my legs like you are." And I said, "You wouldn't?" And she said, "No." And so I was thinking that when I'm sitting out on my porch watching people walk by, I see all these women walk by who are shirtless. And I said to her, "Well, I could never walk around town like you do without a shirt on." And she said, "Really?" And I said, "No." And she said to me, "Well, the top is only for milk." And I kind of had to agree with her. Like, it was a point. Mm-hmm. So it was just odd because, in a sense, my world was being turned upside down. And so many of the ideas were different and new. And some of them I could understand. And there were other things people would say that just baffled me. So every time I left my house or had a conversation, I'm affronted with people who think differently.
Did you ever feel at home?
There were parts I felt at home. I grew to love the river and the birds, learning the names of the birds and their flight patterns and colors and the songs they sang felt very much at home. But I've always loved birds and watching them. And I think as I had children and made it my home, once we moved out of the rest house and we got our own house, it wasn't much, but it was ours, you know, so I could do a few things and make it home.
You're listening to a Main Street interview with Jill Condell, the author of So Many Africas, 6 Years in a Zambian Village. The conversation continues with a look at gender roles after this break.
support for Prairie Public comes from Cable One, offering high-speed internet at 50 megabits per second with 24/7 customer support. Cable One high-speed internet. More information at 1-855-CABLE-1. And by Ide Bailey, a regional CPA firm that brings diverse talents, industry experience, and service specialties to every interaction with its 44,000 clients nationwide. Online at eidebailly.com.
Jill Condell moved from the plains of North Dakota to Zambia in South Central Africa shortly after her marriage. Her husband, Johan, was working to improve production agriculture in that part of the world. She sat down with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg in January to discuss her book, chronicling an oftentimes difficult life in Zambia.
There's a lot of issues in your book where I sort of feel like there's grappling with gender roles. For example, there's times that you say, but I was a good wife if there's been a situation. And I hope you'll allow me this sort of indelicate question here. But Johan asks you to consider moving to Africa just days after you guys are engaged, and you end up moving just weeks after you are married. And Africa is a place, especially at that time, where you needed a wife at home because it took all day to make the food and to keep the house free of cockroaches. Do you ever allow yourself to think that he asked you to come with him because he needed a wife? And I know that sounds mean.
I would say I don't think that would be true, because he had lived in Africa for 3 years, and at that time he had a servant. And the whole issue of servanthood is very hard for Americans to understand, but most Africans have servants, and it's considered a good job. So there are many reasons he married me, but I think he could have done that part of Africa. Well, he had done that without me. Having said that, I played the role of a servant in many ways. I think coming out of the 80s, coming out of a very conservative background, looking at how my dad treated my mother, and, you know, the 50s marriage was my parents' marriage. So in that generation, I was mimicking, I think, what I saw. Mm-hmm. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She was a good mom. She did many things well. And so I started out my marriage imitating her. And the thing that to me is interesting is Johan grew up in the Netherlands. Post-World War II was a very different Netherlands than it is now. So his parents were extremely conservative, and his mom was a stay-at-home mom, and his dad worked. So on both sides of our marriage, we had seen the same things growing up. And I think that's one of the big changes that our marriage has gone through over the years. We've been married for 33 years now, and we have come to a better understanding of each other and our needs. And it used to be what's good for him, or what's good for the job. And I think that's turned around so much. And now when we make decisions, it's what's good for us, not necessarily him, not necessarily me. So we came through this journey of being very different, being very separate. Who am I to you? Who are you to me? And kind of finding our way into being a team. And I'd say that took a lot of work.
Yeah, there's a line in your book, and I'm having to paraphrase it, but it's, how can you really know your spouse until your wedding ring is sort of banged and bruised with
right.
all those years?
Yeah, yeah.
I made my husband read that line.
But, you know, we go into marriage not knowing each other. I went into Zambia not knowing Zambia, and so much of life is like that. And we learn if we're open to allowing ourselves to ask the questions and listen to the answers.
You have 4 children.
Correct.
And 2 of them were born in Africa.
Yes.
Another indelicate question here. Is that something that you wanted to do while you were in Africa, or is there a a case of lack of access to birth control here?
Oh, no, I always wanted children. I would have had eight if we could have. So having the kids, staying in Zambia was really not such a big question. It was easier to do. So I think when you're young and you're naive, looking back now, if my daughter went to Zambia and was living in a small village with hardly any medical care and was pregnant, I would not be happy at all. So I think you just learn through maturity. And I was dumb, you know, naive, just had the world by the tail. We can do this. Everything's going to be fine. So, and part of that's good, but part of it is not real.
Did you ever get an inkling that, that your mom felt like saying, lady, what are you thinking?
Yes.
She said as much, I guess.
Yeah, but she's, you know, she allowed me to live my life and dream my dreams and travel where my heart took me. So I give her a lot of thanks for that, because it wasn't easy for her to sit home and read my letters, you know, and hear about things that we were going through.
Talking of having kids and being pregnant in Africa years and years ago, even, I mean, the situation is likely dire enough in many parts of Africa, even now, 30 years ago. Oh, were you scared at all during these pregnancies? And I mean, there's chapters in your book where you talk about watching them use the same needle over and over for inoculation.
Yeah. You'd think I would have been. I'm a nurse, and I should have known better. But to be honest, I don't know that I was scared. Women in our village had babies all the time. It was normal and more natural, maybe.
Sure.
Yeah.
That makes sense. In some instances, though, being white does have privilege. It comes with its own privileges in
it
Africa.
Does.
There's a part where you demand a new needle.
Right. It was odd being one of 10 white people in a district of about 100,000 people who were Zambian. And sometimes when I went to buy something at the store, people would make me move to the front of the line. Oh. And it was very awkward. Like, if I said no, then I wasn't respecting what people were asking of me. And if I said yes, then I felt like I was taking advantage of a situation. So to be honest, I didn't know how to properly respond a lot of times. And that's part of what living in a different culture is like. You're offered two different things that you can do, and sometimes you don't know which one is the best, or maybe one's better for you, but it's not better for the person you're talking to. So there's a lot of negotiation, and it makes you really tired.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public, an interview first aired in January with Jill Condell, the author of So Many Africas, 6 Years in a Zambian Village. She grew up in Valley City, then moved 8,400 miles away as the crow flies to a tiny village in Zambia in South Central Africa. She was there to further her husband's agriculture work. And she spoke with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg in January.
Jill, this maybe isn't the best way to do research, but I did a Google image search on Calabo, and I did also a Google image search on Sudan. And you get very different image results today. And I wonder, has there been a large impact from your husband's work some 30 years down the road? It looks like a far more settled place than some parts of Africa still.
Well, Africa is a huge continent. So you can talk about Johannesburg, which is as advanced and affluent as any city in America, or you can talk about a village like Calabo. While we were there, I know that the rice production doubled in the district that he worked in. And I know he made some progress. To be honest, I haven't kept up with agriculturally what's going on there right now.
Have you been able to keep in touch with anyone from your village?
No. postage is too expensive. Most villagers would not afford the price of a stamp, and to write back and forth is just something that doesn't happen. We've kept in touch with a few of the Dutch workers that we knew who were there. But that was a long time ago, too.
And you've never been back in all that time?
I haven't. My husband goes back a couple times, once or twice a year, and he's been to other countries but not back to Zambia.
Is there a reason you haven't been back?
I'm not really wanting to go back. I feel like there were a lot of years of my life that were very difficult. When I came back from Zambia, I hid a lot of my stories and didn't talk about them, and I didn't know what to do with them, and that was the main impetus to start me writing. I had nightmares a lot about Africa. I dreamed every night, I would say, about some of the starvation we saw, the ugliness, the flies, the smells. And writing was a way that helped me process those years. And so when I finished writing, I finished dreaming. Hmm. It was very strange. I woke up one day like normal, went to my computer, sat down to write. I didn't have anything else to say. I'd written Africa out. And so that same night, my dream stopped, and I've never dreamed about Africa since. So to go back, I don't have any great desire to go back. I think I'm happy to have written it away.
It's your therapy. In the editing process, I mean, is it hard to hand that off to somebody and say, this is so much of my life in this book, and be gentle?
It's been a long process. I've been writing it for 14 years, and I write creative nonfiction, so I start out by writing essay. And so 8 of the chapters in this book have already been published in lit journals as essays. What was hard was gathering all the essays together and changing them and making them into a whole and changing the arc to get the story all together. So I'm used to having people edit and work with my work. And when I sent it in to the Autumn House Press contest, it was, in my mind, fairly finished and what I wanted it to be. I think as a writer, you have to have a tough skin. I'm used to getting a lot of rejection letters, getting some acceptance letters. But over the years of being a writer and being edited and being rejected, it's just part of the process. So no, when I handed it off, it wasn't like, be gentle. It was more like, if you find mistakes in this book, please tell me, because when it goes to press, I want it to be a clean copy. I want it to be good. So editing to me is a gift. It's not something to fight against. To have someone else read your book and say, I got all of this, but this paragraph doesn't work, then I can go back and change that, which is good.
And especially in the beginning of the book, it's written in present tense. How did you put yourself back in that?
I got out all my old letters, old diaries, journals, 8mm film, believe it or not, VHS film, cassette tapes. So I spent a lot of time just rereading, re-listening to who was that young woman so many years ago, because you forget. So it was a lot of research to put the book back together. And the hard part wasn't the facts. The hard part was to go back emotionally and write about things that I had pushed away for so long and didn't want to talk about.
I'm really curious on the website, and that's Jill Condell, JillKandel.com. To buy this book, there's actually 3 price structures on there. And right away, it doesn't say the price of the book, but it does say if you buy here, $3.50 goes to the author. If you buy here, I think it's a dollar goes to the author. And then the third price structure is through Amazon, and you get 21 cents. And that's just interesting to me as sort of a 21st century writer to have that price structure. Why did you choose to do that?
Well, the book sells for $19 from Autumn House Press, and I wanted to make it available locally and be able to send out signed copies. So I thought, well, I'll just sell it myself from my website, and that's the wonder of new technology. You know, I have a website, I can sell my own book, and you hook up with WooCommerce and PayPal, and it's all very easy. I don't make much money when I sell with Amazon, and I was very surprised at that, actually, because this is all new for me. I've been writing 14 years, but having a published book is like getting a new job without a job description. So when I started, I had no idea what earning out was, what royalties were, what advanced review copies are, how do you get people to blurb your book. So the whole process from acceptance to publication has been a huge journey in itself.
Well, I think judging by your book, you're pretty good at taking
journeys. That's true.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for your time today. We sure appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Jill Condell is the author of the book, So Many Africas, 6 Years in a Zambian Village.
You can get a copy of the book at Zanbros in Fargo or online at jillcondell.com. That's JILLKANDEL.com. Or at Amazon.com or with the Autumn House Press. This interview first aired in January. Coming up next, The Introvert Manifesto.
Programming on Prairie Public is supported by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 138 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
Today we're talking books. Book lovers are often seen as introverted, the type to find pleasure in time alone rather than at big gatherings. Well, Peter Vogt is just such an introvert, and he found himself defending his personality just enough to have to write something of an owner's manual. It's called The Introvert Manifesto, Introverts Illuminated, Extroverts Enlightened. Ashley Thornburg and I spoke with him in March, and we learned that most of us are a little bit of introvert and extrovert, and we tend to ballpark just how much of each we have.
There are some ways that you can find out. You can take the Myers-Briggs type indicator and get an idea, but most people just have a general sense of it as they grow up and as they move on through their years.
Yeah, I was intrigued by the book that you really consider it to be a spectrum, and that really you kind of make the argument that no one is just an introvert and no one is just an extrovert.
No, that's exactly right. I write in the book, there's no such thing as an introvert. It's just shorthand. And, you know, even in the book title, The Introvert Manifesto comes off the tongue a lot better than the manifesto of the guy who prefers introversion most of the time.
But the word manifesto does jump out because obviously you feel pretty strongly about this and you identify as an introvert.
I absolutely do. And I do feel strongly about it. I went around and around with that word manifesto because it is kind of a loaded word, if you will. But basically, to me, it just means you feel very strongly about something and you have something to say. And that's why I ultimately went with that word.
Well, introvert itself is kind of a loaded word, and I think especially the synonyms that come to mind when you first hear that word introvert.
Shy, aloof, cold, standoffish, that sort of thing. Whereas the extroverts, they seem to get the good ones. They get gregarious, they get social, they get outgoing.
So a not too subtle indication that we should aspire to be extroverts if you're looking at the environment we're in, the culture we're in.
That's the message that many introverts get. Now, you can debate whether that's accurate or not. That's another matter. A lot of introverts end up thinking something must be wrong with me. A lot of the things that it seems like I'm supposed to enjoy, I just don't. I wrote a thing in the book, a little parody almost. There was an introvert and an extrovert talking about what they're going to do after work. And typically, an extrovert might invite me out for something after work, and I say, I'm kind of tired, I just want to go home. And that's when the badgering will often come on, and they'll say, come on, you're going to miss all the fun.
You're antisocial.
You're antisocial, you're going to miss all the fun. So I turned that around and I said, you know, what if the introvert were to say to the extrovert, man, you're going to miss all the solitude if you just if you go to a party, you're going to miss all the solitude. And you, come on, why don't you come and do some solitude with me? I just don't do that as an introvert, no introvert.
How would your personality traits reflect this introversion?
Well, I like my alone time like most introverts do. That doesn't mean I always want to be alone. But basically what it means is that I need my alone time each day to think and to process and to have some time to just recharge. I think that if you were to talk to the man or the woman on the street and say, what is an introvert? They probably would say a shy person. A shy person is really something different. It's very related. Introverts can be shy. Extroverts can be shy too. Shyness introduces a fear element into this whole mix. When I was in junior high school and I was in love with a girl from afar and I couldn't go up to her to talk to her, I wasn't standing back saying, you know what, I just don't have the energy for this as an introvert. What I was really saying is I'm terrified of talking to this girl and looking like an idiot and feeling stupid. That's shyness. That's social anxiety, and that's something we can all work on if we have that. Whereas introversion is just a part of who I am. I like my alone time. I like to have time to think. I like to focus on one or two things at a time instead of 10. I would rather know 3 things in a lot of depth than 10 things in a lot of breadth.
Do you think, though, that, I mean, especially in a hugely global society and just a large society at that, that introverts do need to learn a little bit? I know you've used the phrase coming out of their shell, and you don't like that phrase. But for want of a better term, just to integrate in society better?
Of course you have to. There's no denying that. You have to learn your social skills. You have to learn your communication skills. You have to learn to get along with others on a team, let's say at work or whatever it might be. But if you know about yourself that you also need this other part of life, basically all you're looking for is a balance. I would never argue for a 100% introvert sort of life. That being said, I want to make sure that I as an introvert and all introverts also just respect and acknowledge that introverted part of yourself and take care of it so that you're happy and healthy.
The full title of your book is The Introvert Manifesto, Introverts Illuminated, Extroverts Enlightened. So we're illuminating a bit the introvert piece here. We're shedding some light on a behavior, a personality trait, or set of traits. Well, let's do a little enlightenment here for extroverts, because obviously you've got an issue with extroverts who don't understand you.
I mean, sometimes extroverts in my life have badgered me to do things that I don't want to do, or seemingly so. And it seems like extroverts, to some degree, not all extroverts, I would never go that far, but to some degree, they do want you to be the way that they are. Whereas I, as an introvert, tend not to demand that of extroverts in return. I realize I'm making a huge blanket statement when I say such a thing. The teeter-totter of life seems to be favored in the extrovert direction in our culture. I don't think it should be flip-flopped into the introvert's direction. I just wish it would be a little bit more balanced, and I wish that for the sake of introverts and extroverts both.
We have a question from Laura in Fargo on Facebook, and she asks, what do you find to be the most misunderstood thing about introverts?
This whole need for alone time, the whole need for solitude. Let's say you've got you have an extrovert and an introvert and a couple, and a married couple, and they both come home from work on a Friday, and they're exhausted. The extrovert might very well want to go out to a party that night. The introvert might very well want to do the exact opposite, sit and read a book, and it leads to a lot of conflict. And the introvert in that situation, who I can more readily relate to, is simply just wanting to recharge their batteries, and it can be seen as you're being antisocial, you don't want to be with other people. And that's not really the case at all. It's just a way of recharging my batteries so that I can be with people, and I do like being with people and socializing just as much as extroverts do. But I get to a point where I need to stop and recharge my batteries, and that tends to be the most misunderstood element of being an introvert.
In your book, that was actually the element that really caught me most by surprise, and that is that the introvert, when stimulated, may actually run out of energy. You get tired.
Exactly, and it is a physical thing as well as a mental thing. you're just drained at the end of a day. And the way that I recharge as an introvert is just not the same as the way an extrovert might recharge. And it's not to say that one is worse than the other or one is bad and one is good. It's just different.
I think you brought up another interesting thing when you said the alone time, because to me, well, and to everyone really, there is a remarkable difference between being alone and being lonely. So what do those mean to you?
Lonely is something nobody ever wants to be, in my experience. I often want to be alone to recharge my batteries or to read or whatever it might be. But lonely, there's a sadness element. Lonely, there's a longing to be with somebody, and you can't for whatever reason. Whereas alone time, solitude, is a choice that I make to recharge my batteries. Sometimes I would like to be alone, literally all alone. Sometimes I want to be alone at the coffee shop with a few other people around.
Mm-hmm. I think everybody has those moments.
Yes, absolutely. So even that is a little bit different. But lonely, the difference for me, I guess, is between lonely and alone time is that when you're lonely, you really desperately want to be with somebody for whatever reason, and you just can't be. The circumstances aren't allowing it, and that makes you sad and miserable, which makes sense.
Well, in your manifesto, you point out the four pillars of introvert well-being. So lay those out for us.
The first one is solitude. Am I getting alone time? Am I getting some quiet time to myself every day? The second one is reflection. Am I getting some time to think? Am I getting some time to think before I have to say something? Am I getting some time to think after I've said something in case I want to rephrase it or revisit it? The third pillar is focus. Am I able to focus on one thing at a time, one person at a time, instead of 10? And depth is the final one. Am I able to get into some depth when I'm talking to somebody, like I'm talking to the two of you now, for example? Or am I able to get into some depth in a relationship with somebody or on a book that I'm reading? If you talk to an introvert and you say, what's the perfect vacation activity? A lot of them will say, you know what, I'd love to just read a good book by the beach. And I think the reason that that matters to them is because it takes care of these four pillars. You've got your solitude, you've got your thinking, you've got your focus, and you've got your depth. You're lost in a good book. It couldn't be better.
How important is it for people to understand their place on the spectrum of introversion and extroversion?
Well, I mean, it's important for two different sets of people, introverts being the first set of people, because, like I said, we've talked a bit about this. A lot of introverts tend to think that something's wrong with them because of the way that they've grown up or whatever it might be. And it's important to just understand that where introversion is concerned, it's just part of who you are. Even if you're pretty well adjusted as an introvert, as many are, then it comes to the idea of taking care of yourself and using those four pillars, in my case, to take care of yourself to stay happy and healthy. Extroverts, on the other hand, if they can understand introverts a little bit better in their lives, and trust me, this cuts both ways. Introverts need to understand extroverts too. Marriages, parent, child, teacher, student, whatever it might be.
Teacher, student, there it is, because, you know, this takes a remarkable amount of self-actualization and thought to realize, to even know to realize that your personality and someone else's personality might not mesh. And Amy in Moorhead wants to know, do you think that educators are taught to respect different learning styles of the introverts versus the extroverts?
Well, I think it depends on the educator. I think a lot actually are quite familiar with it. My fiance is an educator, and she's very familiar with it. She, in some ways, has to be, so she's hanging around me, but she's also an introvert. I think more and more that educators are really on top of that. Now, whether they're executing that in the classroom is another matter. Sometimes a student who's not talking enough in class or raising their hand enough in class might be pegged as they're not really participating, when they just might simply be an introvert and they're participating very well, but they're just not raising their hand to respond, maybe instantly or at all, or they might go up after class or whatever.
Well, Peter's book is titled The Introvert Manifesto, Introverts Illuminated, Extroverts Enlightened. Well, thank you very much, Peter Vogt, for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me.
You can get a copy of the book at theintrovertmanifesto.com or on amazon.com. The interview with Peter Vogt first aired in March. Decoded 8 book is next.
From the moment you wake up through the chaos of your busy morning, Morning Edition is there with you.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. protesters have been
Through All You Have to Do will bring you all you need to know every weekday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join Morning Edition weekday mornings beginning at 4 a.m. Central Time right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 5th. In 1853, the Army completed a survey to assess the possibility of running a railroad across what was to become North Dakota. The results showed that there was no serious obstacle. Congress chartered the Northern Pacific Railroad in 1864, giving it a land grant of 50 million acres. The railroad enlisted Philadelphia banker Jay Cook to assist with financing. He raised an initial $5 million. After that, the Northern Pacific could build the railroad only as fast as Cook could raise money. The Northern Pacific faced serious financial difficulties. The company's accounting methods were so poor that it was impossible to determine the cost per mile to build the railroad. The officials spent money recklessly, often faster than Cook could raise it. Cook advanced money from his own bank so the railroad construction could continue. It seemed that progress was made in spite of the company rather than because of it. On this date in 1873, the first Northern Pacific train finally pulled into Bismarck. The Northern Pacific was a significant factor in Bismarck's development, and this small settlement grew into a thriving city. The original Northern Pacific Depot was a plain wooden building that would be destroyed by fire in 1898. A new depot was completed in 1901. The prominent architectural firm of Reed and Allen designed a Spanish Revival building. It was a rather surprising choice for the Northern Plains. The Bismarck Weekly Tribune hailed the design and said the building was the finest depot in the entire Northern Pacific system. The Commercial Club of Bismarck boasted that the depot was noted for its beauty and was one of the notable sights in the city. Everyone agreed that Bismarck could be justifiably proud of the new edifice. In 1916, the depot serviced 24 passenger trains daily, but passenger train travel declined by the 1950s. The Northern Pacific merged with four other lines to become the Burlington Northern, and passenger traffic was discontinued. In 1977, the Bismarck Depot was entered into the National Registry of Historic Places. For a time, it was used by Amtrak, but the last passenger train pulled out of Bismarck in 2009, and today, the old depot houses the Fiesta Villa Mexican Restaurant. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street, in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
Monday on Main Street, we're going to have fun talking with Dr. Marty Grothy, a retired psychologist, a management consultant, and a popular speaker. He's written six word and language books, and the one we're going to talk about is titled Oxymoronica, a paradoxical wit and wisdom from history's greatest wordsmiths. When you hear something like less is more, that's what he's talking about. Oxymoronica with Dr. Marty Grothy, Monday on Main Street.